This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Mario Ritter in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight.
But in the end, there's a fundamental differences over who claims the direction and who claims ownership over the transition.
That's Joseph Siegel, director of the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, talking about the keys remaining to issues between Sudan's military and protesters. Also, changes to United States travel document policy could mean fewer U.S. visa renewals for Nigerians. And people in Zimbabwe are now facing power outages as the country struggles with its main electrical generation center facing problems. We'll have these stories and more, so stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, Sudanese army rulers and protest leaders agreed today on a 3-year transition period for transferring power to a full civilian administration, although negotiations over a new sovereign ruling body remain unfinished. The protest movement is demanding a civilian-led transition following 30 years of rule by President Omar al-Bashir. But the generals who toppled him last month have been holding on to a leadership role. Joseph Siegel, director of the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, spoke to VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawy about what is next for Sudan.
I think we have to be cautious about what we're seeing come out of Khartoum. They've laid out some of the general structures of what a transitional government would entail, but they still have to provide the details of what seems the most important of these governing entities, the Sovereign Council, which is supposed to be 11-member governing committee. And that seems to be where the real decision-making will take place. And at this point, there is still disagreement about who will be the main driver of that council. And I think this just speaks to the ongoing tension and disagreement between the military leaders and the protesters over the direction of the country.
Could the composition of the Sovereign Council be a sticking point?
Well, I think it can be. I think it's at the center of the disagreement. The protesters want a majority of the members to be civilians and reformist. The military wants to retain control. The government under President Bashir has been a military-dominated government. And even with his ouster, it is the military who's calling the shots. And they want to retain that control. And so I think they're negotiating to try to ensure that there's a majority military representation on that. And so I think how they navigate that is very much at the heart of where this will go. On the positive side, it seems at least they're both sides are acknowledging that they need some representation from the others. But in the end, there's a fundamental differences over who claims the direction and who claims ownership over the transition.
The two sides also agreed to form a new transitional civilian government to run the country's day-to-day affairs. How would such civilian government be formed?
A lot of these details are yet to be announced and determined. I think the expectation is that there would be a cabinet identified, and the different cabinet ministers would then be responsible for the day-to-day management of the government. But again, I think their direction will largely come from that sovereign council. And so all of these things are going to be interconnected.
During the transitional period, a new parliament will be composed of 300 members, of which 67% will be from the Alliance for Freedom and Change, and the rest will be from other political groups. Would such majority for the Alliance preserve the goals of the Sudanese revolution?
Well, I think it's a positive step in that with a strong majority of representatives from the alliance, that they have the potential to institutionalize a lot of the reforms that are going to be necessary. And I think that's important to keep in mind, that a real transition involves more than a change in leadership. It involves changing the laws. It involves changing the institutions that have long dominated government there in Sudan. And you've had power vested with certain part of the Bashir party, as well as the military, for decades. And it's going to take some time to disentangle politics from all of the state institutions. So to the extent that the parliament will be in a position to pass laws and, in fact, reform the constitution to ensure that there's broader participation and more equity within Sudanese society, that's a good step for really sustaining the change. But much will be dependent on how the sovereign council is determined.
That was Joseph Siegel, director of the Africa Center for Strategic Studies. He spoke with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawy about what is next for Sudan. The United States will require that Nigerians wishing to extend their travel documents will have to undergo an interview. The U.S. Embassy in Nigeria issued a statement yesterday saying that Nigerians seeking to renew their non-immigrant visas must apply online and appear in person to be interviewed. The measure took effect yesterday. The U.S. Embassy said it put the new measures in place to provide more efficient customer service and promote legitimate travel. It affects thousands of Nigerians who travel to the U.S. every year. The earlier policy usually did not require Nigerians to be interviewed when they reapply for U.S. visas. The new rules take effect 1 month after reports saying the U.S. is considering new restrictions on countries whose citizens overstay their visas. Nigerians made up the third largest national group overstaying their visas, the report says. A likely result of the new policy could be a reduced number of non-immigrant visa renewals being approved. Nigerians currently receive 25% of all African non-immigrant visas for the U.S. A recent report says the defense headquarters in Nigeria claims it has nothing to do with a document calling for the overthrow of President Muhammadu Buhari. The report by the News Agency of Nigeria says the Deputy Director of Defense Information noted the report and accused the group Nigerian Continuity and Progress of spreading it. The document, the official said, calls for an interim government to replace the elected government. The officials said the Armed Forces of Nigeria wishes to dissociate itself from the document. He added that the Armed Forces condemn the author of the document and is mindful of its constitutional responsibilities. Flooding caused by Cyclone Idai affected 1 million people across Mozambique, Zimbabwe, and Malawi in March and forced hundreds of thousands out of their homes. But in Malawi, some communities were spared because of flood mitigation projects sponsored by the World Food Program. Lamech Messina reports from Zomba.
Residents of Mwambananji village in the Zomba district of southeast Malawi were among millions of people had hit by the El Nino weather phenomenon in 2015, which caused drought and floods. The floods damaged houses and washed away thousands of crop fields, leaving 6.7 million people in dire need of food assistance. This is nearly half of the Malawi's population. Kenneth Scott is one of the affected villagers.
Mbuyo mu kunale ma floods, mazi amata kwenda paliposi.
Scott says they were heavily affected by the floods, which completely left their houses in water because of the water coming from the nearby rivers. But this year, Scott was not affected by the floods caused by Cyclone Idai, which killed 60 people and displaced nearly 90,000 others in the country's 15 districts, including Zomba. This is largely because of a World Food Program-funded project designed to mitigate the impact on communities living in flood-prone areas. The program, started 4 years ago, is helping more than 10,000 households in Blanta, Balaka, and Zomba districts. Kiganzi Nyakato heads the WFP sub-office in southern Malawi.
So what we do is that we work with the communities to see how we can stabilize their food production. So it's either farming techniques or the type of seeds that they're using, and we work with them to have vegetable gardens.
The program also requires beneficiaries to work in groups to dig deep trenches and construct concrete blockades across rivers, trapping water runoffs during flooding. Scott says the construction projects paid off when Cyclone Idai struck in March. He says there were heavy rains this year, which would, in his words, have put our lives at risk. Maybe you would not have found us here, but the deep trenches which we dug helped trap all the water that would have damaged and washed away our crops. He says, because of this, only a small amount of water reached the homes. He said, Scott, however, says the challenge is that poverty is forcing some people to vandalize the blockades and cut down trees that were planted to contain soil erosion. He says we wish that residents who live in surrounding areas could be financially empowered through loans in order to start some businesses that would help put a stop to the vandalism. In the meantime, the WFP continues to provide food and non-food items to flood survivors in the affected areas. It plans to extend the flood mitigation program to more than 40,000 households by 2020. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Zomba, Malawi.
Zimbabweans are enduring rolling electricity blackouts because of problems at the country's main power generation plant, the Kariba Power Station. Addy Gondo gives us more on the story.
A drought has cut water levels. That means the hydropower dam run by the Zambezi River Authority, jointly run by Zambia and Zimbabwe, is producing less electricity. Zimbabwe's Kariba Power Station has cut output by a third. In the past, Zimbabwe relied on electricity imports from Mozambique and South Africa at a cost of about $5 million a week. But last year, the country cut power imports. The Zimbabwe Electricity Transmission and Distribution Company is urging clients to use power sparingly. Before he was removed from the job on Tuesday, Energy Minister Joram Gumbo warned the problem was extensive.
It's very well known that the water levels at Kariba have gone very low, to the extent that we might not be able to generate power by October if we don't manage our waters well. And also that we are also having challenges at Tiwange because of coal supply, which are caused by breakdowns of machinery, which has become very, very old. And that has now forced us as a ministry to make sure that we look at other means, to make sure that the nation does not go dark.
Gumbo was replaced by former Deputy Minister of Transport, Fortune Chassis. Most Zimbabweans now endure 10 hours of power outages a day. Economic analyst Dumis Banda sees government inefficiency lying at the heart of the inadequate power. He notes that major problems persist at the Wange coal-fired power plant, the country's largest.
The urban thermal power stations have been operating with low capacity for a long time. The rehabilitation of Wange is always a story. It has never been done efficiently. so underproducing. You know, you have been following the corruption at Bangekele, that the corruption by government officials, their point is they put the company to the grave.
Sibanda thinks breaking up Zimbabwe Electricity Supply Authority, ZESA, would help the situation in the long term.
ZESA for some time is at a very weak balance, but they continue to manage a company that is technically insolvent. And they have been importing power. The reason why it was not coming out clear is power. But now it is forex challenge. And why should we be spending gas foreign currency? It demands ZESA. Privatize the thermal power station and retain Kariba as part of government, because it's not a difficult plant to run. At least that would lower the risk.
Those Banda thinks privatizing operations would improve the power generation situation. He says that embedded political interests may block attempts to do so. Reporting for VOA, this is Adigod.
Zimbabweans grappling with the poverty as the economy continues to struggle are using every chance they get to air their anger at the government. One such incident happened over the weekend at a government-organized meeting in the town of Chinoy, a place where the ruling ZANU-PF party can normally count on strong support. Columbus Mavunga reports.
Pro-government statements are the norm in Chinoy, the hometown of former President Robert Mugabe. But that was not the case at a public meeting Saturday. Doug Taylor Frim, a former leader of the predominantly white Zimbabwe Commercial Farmers Union, was among those who spoke.
When President came into power, he made an appeal to the world. Please can all those financial institutions come into Zimbabwe and bring investment here. Our president, there's no need for him to be traveling all around the world looking for this money. It's here. But we just need the right documentation so we can put the right security in place. And I promise you, overnight, there will be a huge change.
When he speaks of documentation, Frim is talking about giving farmers the legal right to their land. Most white commercial farmers were pushed off their land in the early 2000s by the government and replaced by black peasant farmers. Those new farmers have no guarantee they will be allowed to stay and no collateral to use to borrow money from banks. Without those, Frim argues, the farms cannot be productive. Even blacks who benefited from the land reforms, like tobacco farmer Ronnie Masango, say unless the Reserve Bank of Zimbabwe addresses chronic shortages of cash and finds a way to preserve the value of the local currency, the bond note, the Southern African country's economy will not recover. I hear people keep on saying parallel market, parallel market. Where is that money coming from? Asks Masango. At the banks, I cannot access my money. But in the streets, I see people using cash as their tools, he said. We want cash in the banks, not in the streets. So you'll soon see commotion in the streets since traders show off. Parallel market is the source of our economic problems. That is where corruption starts. Ziyambi Ziyambi, Zimbabwe's Minister of Justice, says only patience will help as the country goes through what President Mnangagwa calls austerity for prosperity measures to reverse years of recession under former President Mugabe.
To be fair to Reserve Bank does not create a parallel market. A parallel market or a black market is created by shortages. So what we are doing is to come up with austerity measures. The moment we have a scenario where our production increases, we kill the parallel market. We have to acknowledge that we have had 20 years or so where there was no development.
It remains to be seen if the Reserve Bank of Zimbabwe can assure citizens and farmers like Ronnie Masango that the economy will stabilize. There was a round of nationwide demonstrations in January when fuel prices increased. The opposition has indicated that more protests will materialize unless things improve. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Chinoy, Zimbabwe.
As thousands of technology professionals gather in Kigali this week, many African software developers say a big problem they face is that government does not value their work. Instead, they say African governments favor foreign information and communications technology companies. This, they say, stunts the effort to use technology to transform African economies. Eugene Uwimana has more from Kigali, where the fifth Transform Africa ICT Summit is underway.
Kimenyi Emabre is the Chief Executive Officer of Algorithm Incorporated, a Ghanaian software development company. He says his company has developed software that has eased work for Ghanaians in hotels, pharmacies, and in other sectors. Kimenyi, however, says government still do not value technology made in Africa. Kimenyi says this bad mindset immediately takes away markets for us and younger people in the industry. He adds, there are so many bright young Ghanaian software engineers who are remote cyclists because they can't get a job in what they studied. He says in Rwanda, local companies get only 2% of government's tenders. The rest goes to foreigners. The Smart Africa Alliance of 24 nations sprang from the first Transform Africa Summit in 2013. The alliance's secretariat says it is working to address the problem of governments ignoring African software developers. Didier Nkurikimfura is the Director of Technology and Innovation at the Smart Africa Secretariat.
Because you don't expect someone who doesn't know your problem to come and provide you a solution. If you look at your mobile phone today and the apps that you use, you find that 95% of apps you've downloaded, you don't use them.
In his speech opening the summit, Ghanaian President Paul Kagame said the mindset that undermines Made in Africa initiatives will keep the continent in eternal poverty if leaders don't work on changing it.
There is still this myth we always have to look outside the continent to fund major initiatives. But this simply can't be true when Africa is losing billions every year through lost taxes, sending private assets abroad and other factors. We are not poor, not at all. The issue has more to do with the mindset.
The World Bank estimates that half of all jobs in Africa require technological skills and that sub-Saharan Africa needs to create 230 million new jobs in 2030. The summit's 4,000 delegates from Africa and beyond aim to help address those issues. The meeting is a platform to learn from some of the world's best tech brands and share experiences on how to keep abreast with the ever-changing technological landscape. Among the speakers was Sophia, the first humanoid robot. The robot, which is owned and operated by Hanson Robotics in Hong Kong, said tech startup businesses can bring dramatic change to Africa.
African startups are already working to address shortages of doctors in rural areas. I am so excited to be here in Kigali with humans who share some of these same goals.
Eugene Uwimana for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Mario Ritter in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili evening news coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned for the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer Bill Workinger and our engineer Rob McLean, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
VOA. voaafrica.com.
On voaafrica.com, the news updates never stop. Our primary goal is to keep you informed.
voaafrica.com, your trusted source for news and information.